outskirts of Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else films. I am your co-host, Nick Cooey. I'm joined, as always, by my partner-in-arms, Alex Cooey, and we're here to talk about the latest entry in our 1991 retrospective miniseries, It Smells Like Twin Critics.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're doing well. And I just wanted to start off saying, like, in case I sound like I have a slight congestion, I've been getting over a nasty summer cold that apparently has been spreading throughout the country, so that's why. But don't worry, I'm doing good.
Yeah, no COVID scares in this part of our little corner of the world, thankfully.
No, thank goodness.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I'm just glad you're feeling a little better because, yeah, I mean, for the last couple of weeks, we were going to record this episode, but then, you know, you had this cough that just persisted, and I was...
Yeah, like, cough, runny nose, you know, it was like a very persistent summer cold, but apparently, like I said, it's been kind of like going around. I think kind of like maybe it's because a lot of the country's been in quarantine for the past year, so maybe the summer cold's like, did you miss me?
Yeah, exactly. People are now just getting used to sort of interacting in person rather than just over Zoom. But yeah, it's been a busy time for both of us. You know, I've been hard at work on What If Cinema. We had a few major instances of Nicola Passerotto, our man in Cannes, covering the film festival, and we had some really great interviews with him and some special guests that are available on our Twitch channel. What If Cinema, I mean, it's another little bit of shameless self-promotion, but I'm pretty proud and pretty thrilled with the guests that we were actually able to talk with.
Yeah, I've been following you guys also on Facebook and Instagram. If you want to catch all the latest updates, you can also follow through there.
And Twitter.
Yes, and Twitter.
We cover our bases. I mean, the only thing we don't really have yet is TikTok, but even that we might end up cornering the market on at some point.
Yeah, do you have Snapchat?
Oh, you know what we have? Napster. That's it. Ah. Yeah, we have a Napster account. Yeah.
You're right.
We really want to corner the market, you know.
I mean, you really are covering the bases.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We're trying to be as ubiquitous as possible.
You know, I commend you for that. And yeah, because it's been, you know, it was quite an electrifying con this year, you know, with the titles that have come out there. Even winning some prizes, even the way they were presented in unorthodox manner.
Yeah. I mean, poor Spike Lee. I mean, at least he's taken some accountability for fudging the whole thing up at the end, but...
Well, you know, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess. In any case, I've heard really wonderful things about Tétin, the film that won the Palme d'Or. I'm really looking forward to seeing it when it comes out in October.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to Asghar Farhadi's new film, A Hero, as well as the English-language debut of Apichatpong Virsitakku.
Well, it's also Spanish-language, too, because it's set in Colombia. Yeah. It's Memoria with Tilda Swinton. And Daniel Jimenez, I was trying to say, I always have trouble with his name, but it's the lead actor from Lucrecia Martel's Zama, for anyone who saw that great movie. We actually watched a few months ago, like on our own time, just to kind of give you a frame of reference of how silly it was that Disney and Marvel wanted her to direct Black Widow, which also just came out. But we're not actually going to be talking about Black Widow or Khan or anything else that we've raised up.
But we are going to talk about a noteworthy female director.
That's right, we are. Yeah, because, I mean, we were kind of referencing Tétin being the second film to win the Palme d'Or from a woman director after Jane Campion's The Piano. And we were thinking about a particular film for this entry in Smells Like Twin Critics because we've realized that we haven't really spoken a lot about women directors. And we decided that we want to pick a particularly notable entry by a woman director from 1991. And I went up to you one day, Alex, actually, I think about a month ago, and I was just like, hey, do you want to do Point Break? And you were a good sport, and you were like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Neither of us have seen.
No, which is interesting, because we have seen a fair share of Catherine Bigelow's other works, too. And Point Break was a film that we had been interested in seeing for a while. Though I guess I wanted to ask you, of all, you know, because there were other films from like women directors that came out in 91, but what was it about Point Break that you decided you wanted to focus on that for our retrospective?
Well, I will say this, that this will most likely not be the only film by a woman director that we'll be talking about from 1991. But for this particular instance, I was thinking that the day that we're recording this is July 24th, and the film just recently had its 30th anniversary. It was released in the height of the summer movie season in 1991. And it seemed that, like, well, a pretty natural fit to talk about what is considered something of a cult summer classic.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And Point Break is one of those movies that it really has gained a cult status, because when it came out, the critical reception was kind of mixed. Like, there are critics who did kind of deemed the film as being silly. And yet, partially because of Bigelow's reputation since then, she had won the Oscar for The Hurt Locker.
And made history.
Yeah, making history as the first woman director to win an Oscar for Best Director, and as well as Best Picture. Mm-hmm. But partially because of that, and also because of the influence it's had, like not only having a forgettable remake of its own in 2015, but many would argue an unofficial remake in 2001 with The Fast and the Furious.
Which also, its latest installment just had a screening at Cannes on the beach, which is, I think... It is always funny to think that a Fast and the Furious movie is like screening in the middle of this prestigious festival, but
wouldn't be the strangest title to screen at Cannes. But
either, no.
But yeah. So I think with all of that buildup, and because I don't know about you, but I think the first time I've heard about this movie Point Break was actually through the Edgar Wright film Hot Fuzz 14 years ago.
Have you ever seen Point Break?
No.
Amazing bit in Point Break where they jump over fences.
Is that 29?
That is Swayze's just robbed this bank. And Keanu Reeves is chasing him through people's gardens. And he goes to shoot Swayze, but he can't because he loves him so much. And he's firing his gun up in the air. He's like, oh!
Have
you ever fired your gun up in the air and gone, ah?
No, I have not ever fired my gun up in the air and gone, ah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I can't really remember, Alex, the first time I ever heard of Point Break. I think I may have just... when video stores were a thing, I remember seeing the cover of it, and it's just, you know, just the poster of Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves on the cover with the big wave, and I thought, oh, okay, like, it's a swimming movie, and I just didn't really think about it, but I remember, like, the first time I ever saw any kind of clip from Point Break was in Hot Fuzz, which famously satirized a particularly famous and somewhat lampooned scene from the film, and in fact, the film is still... today regarded as it has some sort of camp value as well. I mean, Riff Tracks did a whole episode about Point Break.
And and it's interesting the legacy it's had, because there's also been kind of like this sort of stage production that was done in 2003 where basically...
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, like there's this stage production where in 2003 called Point Break Live, which they pick a random person from the audience to take on the Keanu Reeves role and to read lines off of cue cards, while other actors on stage would reenact the movie.
That's so it has kind of a Rocky Horror Picture Show sort of quality in that, in terms of interactivity or like the room. But like, and it's interesting because like the way we're describing it, it sounds like the kind of movie where it's so bad it's good. And you'd think, like, you know, Alex, on this show we've talked about Edward Yang and Krzysztof Kieślowski, you know, it's like, and now we're talking about what is a bank robbery surfer dude action movie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of those things too, like when you hear the premise pitch, it's like, yeah, surfers who double as bank robbers, you think that sounds like that could be very stupid.
Well, and I had a fun time explaining the plot to some people the other day who had never heard of Point Break and they didn't know what it was. And for people who aren't familiar with the plot, let's give you a quick rundown. Former quarterback star turned FBI agent Johnny Utah, played by Keanu Reeves, is embroiled in a high-stakes case involving these bank robbers called the ex-presidents, because they're dressed like former U.S. presidents, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, and they've hit up, what, 30 banks in
a few years. And Keanu Reeves is partnered up with a senior agent, Gary Busey, who has the theory that it's surfers, because there's some traces that there's like no clues as to who these guys are,
but he has a hunch, and his hunch, you might ask, how It comes from the security footage of one of the bank robbers mooning the camera. And he is like, this guy has a tan line like a surfer. So he must be a surfer.
Yeah, also some traces, like samples, left a crime scene, which matches with the kind of stuff that you'd find at the beach. So Busey kind of tells Reeves, okay, you go undercover pretending to be a surfer and try to, like, get to know the locals around there. See if you can find any clues that could lead you to these ex-presidents, guys.
Exactly. So Reeves ends up embroiling himself with some bad hombres, you might call them, led by the charismatic and zen-like figure Bodhi, played by Patrick Swayze, in probably the most Patrick Swayze-est role of his career. In the sense that, you know, he had this particular persona that was very distinct and yet not easily replicated.
And it was interesting because that was kind of like, I would argue that it was almost at a peak of Swayze's career because, like, it was around that time he was, like, very popular for films like Dirty Dancing, Roadhouse, and, of course, Ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, really, he was riding a wave, so to speak. I promise I'll keep the surfing puns to a minimum during this episode. But it is interesting to contrast him with Keanu Reeves at that point in his career, because Keanu Reeves really was not an action star at all. In fact, this was his major breakthrough in a lot of ways after the Bill and Ted movies. And in fact, I was just looking this up, but Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, the second Bill and Ted movie, came out a week after Point Break in theaters. So it's interesting to think that audiences could go in 1991 into the cinemas, and you could see Keanu Reeves as, you know, Ted Theodore Logan, which is a character that some people were already familiar with him. And, you know, he's goofy and he's boyish and he's a klutz. And then you see Point Break, and it's not that persona was necessarily dispelled, but it's beefed up to a degree. I mean, would you agree with that, Alex? Like, watching him in this movie.
Well, I find it interesting you use the term beefed up, because, like, you know, it's interesting about the casting of Keanu Reeves in there. Actually, it was something that Catherine Bigelow fought for. She reportedly fought for him to play in that role. Because, yeah, like you said, he wasn't an action hero at the time. And, like, when I think of, like, beefed up, I think of, like, you know, in the 80s, you have these, like, for action heroes, you have these machismo stars, like Sylvester Stallone or Schwarzenegger, you know. Mm-hmm. And Reeves' physique doesn't quite match those, you know. He doesn't have that kind of physique, or maybe necessarily that presence, but it was kind of like... But it was interesting that she was trying to advocate for him, and because, like, it was a kind of movie that had been sort of in development hell for a few years, like, Ridley Scott was attached to direct, and actually Matthew Broderick was considered for the role of Johnny Utah.
Mm-hmm. And the script had been floating around since the mid-80s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was. It was. And, you know, but then it wasn't until really Catherine Bigelow and her then-husband James Cameron found out about the script, and they decided they wanted to make it. And actually, they made some uncredited rewrites, which they argued were pretty extensive for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's why Bigelow was so adamant in casting Reeves for that role, is because I think she recognized something in those Bill and Ted movies, and along with others.
Well, because I'm trying to think. Well, because the other big role that Keanu Reeves had that year, actually, which is important to talk about, was also a completely different sort of Keanu Reeves.
Absolutely, yeah. I was going to say that very same year, and we mentioned about this movie before in our Poison review, but yeah, the same year he was also in Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he was really trying to branch out and show, like, I mean, he had been in the movie Dangerous Liaisons before, but I think people weren't used to seeing, like, oh yeah, he wanted to, like, break out into drama.
Yeah, because the only other things I can really think of aside from the Bill and Ted movies was that kind of Babes in Toyland musical.
I was going to say Parenthood also with Steve Martin, but sure.
But it's interesting that he was trying to prove that he had some sort of versatility as an actor. And yet, I don't know. In my opinion, I think that Keanu Reeves is a sort of... He's not cultivated his reputation as being a particularly expressive or emotive actor.
No, I don't think so. And honestly, I think that he's one of those actors who... I think his most interesting work comes from not necessarily his performance, but I think it comes from the way directors utilize him. The way that... why they cast him in particular roles. And I think also why he's cast in here is because I think when you see him in this movie... You can buy him as, like, you know, as he's going undercover to pretend to be a surfer, you buy the surfer persona. Like, right. You, it's in a way that I would never bought if Broderick played that role.
Right. And there's something really interesting that several critics have already raised when talking about the film, is the physical resemblance that he has to Lori Petty's character, who's her name is Tyler. She's also a surfer who kind of, he first meets at the beach when he tries surfing and he completely wipes out on the waves, and she actually saves him. And he just asks her, well, will you teach me how to surf? And
yeah, she basically becomes sort of like his, sort of the key for him to gain access to the surfer community and to this gang of bad hombres, as you put them.
Yeah, and they something of a romance kindles between them.
Yeah, so the script says, but it's interesting because we talked about this, but honestly, we feel like there's actually more, in terms of chemistry between them, I think we felt there's more chemistry between him and Bodhi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we can get into a little more in terms of how that relates to the film's presentation of masculinity and codes of masculine intimacy as well. I just think it's important to note as well that the actors really threw themselves into the physicality of what this film required of them. Because one of the things that's great about a lot of older action movies now, I mean, when I say older action movies, I mean action movies that were coming out in the late 80s and early 90s, was a reliance on practical effects. There were still, CGI was not as ubiquitous as it is today in terms of pulling off these incredible feats of derring do. I mean, the same year, in fact, that same summer, we had James Cameron release his big blockbuster, Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Actually, Point Break, you talked about how like Bill and Ted opened a week after Point Break. Actually, Point Break, when it opened, Terminator 2 was in its second weekend.
So, which, in a way, I feel bad for Kathryn Bigelow because, I mean, that's a little cruddy that her husband's like, okay, I'm going to help you work on this movie, but no. I mean, I don't think that he deliberately opened the movie despite her, but it's unfortunate timing when your movie comes out and then it has to compete against what is the biggest film of the year and also a groundbreaking film in terms of its special effects.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, and that's interesting because like even though Point Break didn't have like maybe the technical wizardry that Terminator 2 had going for it, I do feel like in some ways some people argue there, you know, in the years since then there have been retrospective reviews that argue that Point Break in its own way is a groundbreaking action movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, not just the fact of, like, say, having the casting of Keanu Reeves in kind of the hero role, but also kind of like showing, for example, like there was an article, like I've been reading articles about the film, like there's one from The Telegraph, actually, which in which the writer Robbie Collin was talking about how, like, you have a hero who's heroes who are kind of like, and the male characters kind of express more of their emotional sides or more of an intimacy than what maybe people had seen in action films from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And even like there's a great Rolling Stone article that was written 3 years ago by April Wolf, who called Point Break as the greatest female gaze action movie ever.
Which is, and that's an interesting thing to ponder as well, because Kathryn Bigelow, in her body of work, has not really been what one might call a feminist filmmaker. I don't think that her filmography is anti-feminist at all. I think, in fact, I think it's easy to overlook, especially like at the time when she was making movies, it was just easy to overlook some of the subversion that she was hiding in her films that, or kind of the heft and the seriousness that was in some of her films until The Hurt Locker came out in 2009. And then she earned the kudos and accolades of awards and was sort of canonized as a genuine auteur rather than just someone who made action movies who happened to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, but I just wanted to say, you know, about the whole practical effects of the film. I mean, and in terms of also surfing, you know, Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze and Lori Petty all trained to surf. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Lori Petty had never been in the ocean before this movie, which
Oh, yeah.
That seems like a pretty drastic turnaround. But they had to, so they threw themselves into pretty intensive training. There's a very famous sequence that we can even get into a little bit later, but that involves skydiving, where the actors ended up actually skydiving, and Patrick Swayze jumped off a plane several dozen times. You know, as someone who's afraid of heights, ironically, as a very tall man, I'm afraid of heights, but I don't know if I could again and again and again jump out of a plane at a very high altitude. But apparently Patrick Swayze did, and, you know, he really literally threw himself into the role for this movie.
Yeah, in fact, actually, his trainer, you know, was impressed with the way he went about it, like saying he easily became a natural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, and when you watch, like, the skydiving scenes and the surfing sequences in the film, honestly, I feel like they're very breathtaking just watching it. Even if, like, you know, they may come across as totally absurd. You know, like, for example, there's one of the skydiving scenes involves, like, a character jumping out of a plane without a parachute.
Yeah.
But... I mean, yeah, exactly, yeah.
But at the same time, you're kind of, like, left gobsmacked. You're in awe as you're watching these scenes. Like, of, like, my God, how were they able to pull this off, you know? And it's like... And I think a show, like, even in those films, I think Bigelow's talents as a director, in which he's able to, like, I think... you know, I think she attained a different kind of level with what she's trying to do with the imagery and with the execution of the scenes.
Well, I think it's interesting that, I mean, you've, I think, put it very succinctly, Alex, in terms of the way that a movie like Point Break straddles the line between awe and stupidity. And it's something that a lot of people have noted. And it's something that I think it's been a key component in the film's status as a cult classic. And I would argue it's entirely intentional on Bigelow's part. And I mean, there are moments in this movie where, or these exchanges of dialogue, particularly with Gary Busey, who is very, very intensely Gary Busey-esque.
That's a succinct way of describing his performance.
But it's a pretty wild performance. And there's some line readings that I can't recite verbatim just yet, but they're very you can kind of tell, like, it doesn't surprise me that James Cameron had a hand in rewriting some of this as well, because, like, there's a certain extremeness to the dialogue and particularly the level of camaraderie expressed between the characters that has this sort of intensity that's almost, it can border on the verge of absurd, you know, or even in terms of, like, we were kind of talking about these plot developments. I mean, the fact that there's one scene, for example, where Johnny Utah and his partner just barely miss the ex-president's robbing a bank simply because Johnny Utah's going off to get two meatball sandwiches. and so the film has this reputation as being something of a guilty pleasure, I think, for some people. But is it a guilty pleasure, Alex, or is it a genuinely good movie? And I think that that's something that we can mull over a little bit after the commercial break.
I'm going to get some meatball sandwiches.
Welcome back. We have just gotten meatball sandwiches. Actually, no, we haven't. We should, though.
Yeah, we should.
This episode is brought to you by Mike Subs. Or no, we should have thought ahead of time about getting a sponsor. But in any case, I think it's... I think this whole question about the film's... I think this whole question about the film's value as a movie, and not just as this cult property, is something that I'd like to kind of think a little bit more about, because on the one hand, it's easy to look at a movie like Point Break and dismiss it, as a lot of critics did, as superficial fluff, and that, oh, the film is over-directed and it's compensating for what is ostensibly a half-baked script, riddled with cliches. I mean, there's a very famous line in the movie where Bodhi says something along the lines of, if you want the ultimate, you've got to pay the ultimate price. And it's, you know, it's that kind of level of, that the film, it earnestly leans into its cliches. And yet, by that same token, Alex, do you think that the film is just only a series of cliches, or do you think that there's actual room for subversion?
Oh, I think there's clearly room for subversion, and I think a lot of credit has to be given to Bigelow's direction and also the rewrites that she was involved with. And I because I think she even in her early work pre Hurt Locker, I think she was interested in kind of like subverting these genre tropes, you know, or you know what would be considered like genre films, but like to kind of dissect and analyze and explore them. Like honestly, this movie kind of reminded me of a film she made a few years prior to this, Near Dark, with which featured like Bill Paxton and Jenna Goldstein and Lance Henriksen, and you know, and that's which if you guys don't know that movie, that's like basically kind of like a vampire film, like these kind of vampire drifters.
Something like a vampire western, in a way.
Yes, a vampire western, and which is interesting because actually she describes Point Break as a wet western, which. You know, you take that for what you will, you know, what the meaning of that is. Mm-hmm. But I think it's like she's interested in that, but also kind of like subverting, like to, I think, gain some real insight into like the psychology of her characters and kind of like being earnest and actually, I think, very empathetic with them, too.
I mean, I don't know. I don't agree necessarily with you, Alex, about psychology. I don't think that there's a lot of psychological insight or complexity necessarily in terms of what motivates these characters. I mean, Johnny Utah is a blank slate in a lot of ways. And I think that that's actually mirrored in Keanu Reeves's casting. I think that's a deliberate choice on the part of why Bigelow wanted to cast Reeves in this part is because he is such a, has this naive quality to him that allows him to sort of process things as they're happening to him. And he's thinking that he's trying to make things, he thinks that he's in control of certain situations, but the fact of the matter is, he's proven again and again throughout this movie that he is in control of very little, if anything.
Yeah, well, I think you even told me this before, and I think you're right, where I think Johnny Utah serves as a vehicle for the audience, mm-hmm. where, like, when Utah kind of falls under the spell of Bodhi and is in awe of him, we are in awe of him as well, like, and we can't resist. Even when what he says and does seems completely absurd, we can't help but take the ride.
Right. And I think, you know, I was kind of thinking about this actually while watching it, that the casting of someone like Keanu Reeves in this movie reminded me a lot, oddly enough, of the casting of an actor like Rock Hudson in the movies of Douglas Sirk. And it's something a few years ago, I remember when I first saw Magnificent Obsession, Douglas Sirk's movie, the first one actually he did with Rock Hudson. It was his first movie with Rock Hudson and Jane Wyman. It's deliciously soapy, campy, you know, classic Cirque. And one of the special features on the Criterion DVD is an interview with Catherine Bigelow. And I thought to myself, oh, that's peculiar. I didn't think, you know, I never got the sense that she was ever influenced by Douglas Sirk. Because you think about a movie like Detroit, that's as far away from something like All That Heaven Allows or Written on the Wind as you can think aesthetically, definitely. Aesthetically and tonally, it's very, very different. But, you know, watching Point Break, something clicked for me. And it was about the way that Bigelow cannily understands how aesthetics intersect with cliches and how she can, as a filmmaker, implement these directorial decisions to probe what undergirds these cliches, what actually gives them value. And I think Sirk does the same thing with kind of the melodrama format as well. I mean, he uses that for a lot of social critique. And there's an element of social critique in this movie, particularly with the ex-presidents, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, it's playing with that. And even, like, there's a moment, like, a dialogue where Bodhi has where he talks about, like, how what they're doing, like, he explains the motivation of why they rob these banks. You know, it's like they're kind of their stance against the system.
Right.
Which he feels kind of drags people down and, like, has made people into basically zombies.
This was never about money for us. It was about us against the system. That system that kills the human spirit. We stand for something. To those dead souls inching along the freeways in their metal coffins, we show them that the human spirit is still alive.
Right, but the film is more existential than it is political, I would argue.
Yeah, I would argue that too. And I think that, and for me, like, you know, what a trait that Bigelow has in common between, like, these what are considered, like, kitschy genre films of her earlier works and then more, quote-unquote, prestige pictures like Hurt Locker, is she really likes to focus on these sort of like groups of men and the sort of like the dynamics and relationships with each other, and get to, I think, also kind of like their, the kind of how driven they are, you know, and kind of maybe single-minded, if you will, like with what they do.
Well, it's, she's very interested in deconstructing testosterone-fueled Ubermensches in a way that it's not, I mean, I think what makes, you know, those movies so striking is that she's very empathetic, as you were saying earlier, with obsession, and recognizes that within her predominantly male characters. I mean, there's of course an exception with Jessica Chastain in Zero Dark Thirty. She's one of the few female protagonists in a Bigelow film that's also driven with this single-minded goal to accomplish something, you know. But by and large, she's documented how that obsession manifests within these strict codes of masculine honor and camaraderie, and she understands the absurdity of how these codes manifest in terms of how it gets these guys to the edges of, how it brings them to the brink of death.
Yeah, whether it's, you know, doing, like, riding the surf waves, like, you know, even, like, Swayze wanting to ride this, the 50-year wave where that, it's like, occurs.
Yeah, it's a 50, yeah, a storm occurs every 50 years. He wants to go to Australia to ride the biggest wave on the planet, you know, and
whether it's that or, you know, and I feel like, honestly, that kind of drive, it's not too dissimilar from Jeremy Renner's character in The Hurt Locker.
No, completely. Like, I immediately thought of The Hurt Locker while I was watching this movie.
Yeah, I did too.
But I think that, you know, I think the thing about the difference between this and Hurt Locker, of course, is that The Hurt Locker is, in some respects, it's much more grounded in a realist aesthetic, one might say. I mean, of course, there are moments which the movie has been sort of lambasted for in terms of trying to kind of generate some sensationalist imagery at the expense of verisimilitude. Like, I'm thinking of the famous shot where he pulls all of the bombs up. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, you hear a lot of bomb diffusing experts say, oh, that's absolute nonsense. That wouldn't work. But again, like, Bigelow's always been interested in straddling that line between in terms of kind of like the absurd and the tactile or the real or the recognizable within the everyday.
Yeah, I think she likes to see test the limit, see how far she can go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is exactly like what Cirque would do with his melodramas. He would just push these sequences. I'm thinking, for example, of like in Written on the Wind, has so many scenes that are so extreme tonally. And the way that Cirque directs, like Robert Stack, for example, and Dorothy Malone, it's so cartoonish that, of course, it generates a lot of laughter and it's easily lampoonable. But, I mean, in the case of Cirque, I would argue a movie like Written on the Wind, there's, of course, the desperation that undergirds that extreme aesthetic that he's going for. And in the case of Bigelow, with a movie like Point Break, it's not even just a desperation as much as, I think, a loneliness that is punctured by these acts of just sheer exhilaration. Like, the first skydiving scene in the movie is beautifully directed.
Oh yeah, it's incredible. You know, yeah. I envy those who were able to see it in a theater.
And it's one of those scenes that as I was watching it, I thought to myself, is this really narratively necessary? And of course, like, it does come back at the end of the movie, so it is justified, but it's an interesting, like, in the context of the narrative, like, it's after Bodhi has kind of, I mean, we might as well spoil a little bit of a 30-year-old movie, but after Bodhi realizes kind of that Johnny Utah's not who he says he is, and instead of immediately calling him out on it, he takes him on a skydiving trip with the bros, you know? And it's, again, like, it's one of those things where you're just like, what?
Yeah, honestly, you're kind of wondering, like, where is this going to go? I mean, there's even a, like, a little joke thing where, like, is there going to jump, like, they're like, you take his parachute, Johnny. No, you take mine, you know?
Yeah, because Johnny's clearly kind of paranoid about that his bag is empty. And then Bodhi's like, no, bro, you can take mine. And yeah, it's like they all are kind of messing around with him. And it's goofy, but there's this moment in the middle of the skydiving sequence where Reeves is going down and he's just absolutely thrilled out of his gourd. And they're all holding hands. And it's one of those things that, again, as you're describing it, like, if written on the page, it is it has the potential to be the most cornball saccharine sequence in a movie. And yet somehow Bigelow's direction allows us to see past the cliche, or look rather within the cliche, to find the real poignancy of something like this kinship that forms between men. And then, of course, she follows that up immediately with everything going to shit, because that sort of nirvana, that rush, is punctured by the reality of what they're doing, which is, of course, harmful, and it's destroying lives, and it's not even really politically motivated. It's simply out of this dissatisfaction, this malaise that all of these men have with each other. And that, in a way, positions the movie, as I think some critics have written about this in the past, I'm sure, but that it positions the movie as kind of an entry within this end of the millennium subsection of movies about a crisis in masculinity, so to speak.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, again, it's like, and that's why I like that with a movie like Point Break, it falls on, I think you could justify and argue that it would fall under these sort of like subcategory of films that maybe people wouldn't necessarily associate Point Break with, like that, or even like, you know, like even with its homoerotic overtones, like with the relationship between Johnny and Bodhi, you know, like it's not necessarily considered to be a queer cinema like Poison or anything.
No. It's not.
Or even Idaho, but still, there's like that. You know, when you have scenes like, for example, when they're playing football on the beach, you know, these shirtless buff guys, and even the point where like Johnny gets a little aggressive, like chasing after Bodhi and like tackles him in the water.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's this. It is so funny that when Bodhi first appears in the film, and the way that Bigelow captures that sequence in terms of a shot reaction shot, and we implicitly assume the perspective of Johnny when we look at Bodhi. And in that respect, she is, the way she films Swayze as well. I mean, she's making him look attractive. And in that way, there's this attraction that Keanu Reeves has toward him. And it's not necessarily romantic. It's not something you can pigeonhole into one simple category. But she understands the complexity of that attraction and dispels a lot of this toxic masculine belief of that, oh, boys can't be close, or you can't acknowledge the beauty or the allure of another man. But in a way that she's not assuming that, she's not, again, co-opting the politics of something like in New Queer Cinema, either.
No. And it's interesting, too, because, like, you know, the character of Tyler, for instance, actually, in the original script, she was written to be more like a typical California blonde sort of girl. But it was actually Bigelow and Cameron who decided to kind of change her up, where then her appearance is kind of more androgynous. Even the name itself is androgynous, mm-hmm. You know, Tyler.
And like I was saying earlier, like, her physical resemblance to Reeves is, like, very, very striking. There's a particular shot of them both in bed overhead where they look almost identical. It's almost kind of eerie. And that's, yeah, I think, completely intentional on Bigelow's part. I think as the movie is now, the one thing about Point Break that also, I think, makes it age surprisingly well is, we've been talking a little bit about Bigelow's direction in terms of how she films her actors, how she aestheticizes the locations and the bodies that we see in motion performing these really outstanding and truly awesome feats of derring do. But the thing that also I think about her direction, which is really commendable and I think has to be mentioned, is that as an action director, she's one of those filmmakers who knows exactly what she's doing in the set piece when she introduces every single element within a sequence, and not a single one is wasted, and yet it's not telegraphed to the degree that the scene becomes boring. And I think that the particular scene I'm thinking about, and it's one that I'm surprised people don't talk about as often, is that there's a sequence in the middle of the movie, roughly halfway through, where Reeves and Busey are performing a raid on this one surf house that it might house the perps, who are the ex-presidents. We know that they're not the ex-presidents, but we know that these guys are bad dudes, and they're wanting to bust these guys. And there are all these little characters and props. For example, there's somebody who's running a lawnmower outside, so Reeves can't, you know, walkie-talkie some of the other officers and warn them of the danger that Gary Busey is in. There's also a woman who's taking a shower at one point. And again, these are all little details at first that are introduced in a sense that you think, oh, they're completely incidental.
Oh, they're background dressing.
Completely. They're set dressing. But then when Bigelow executes the sequence, it's actually quite breathtaking in terms of how all of these elements unexpectedly come into play. And it's truly, I mean, for me, I had an absolute, it reminds me of the sequence in Mad Max Fury Road when Max first meets Furiosa. And that's a sequence too where all these different elements are introduced and then a fight happens and not one of those elements is wasted. They all serve a purpose and yet it's not schematic.
Yeah, and like when the way that the elements come into play during the sequence, you know, I was laughing at points, you know, out of like a genuine surprise and delight, like seeing how it comes into play, but like in ways that you wouldn't expect coming mm-hmm. into the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's in a care of like of her many strengths, I think of how good an action director Bigelow is.
Well, as I think just, I mean, let's just put it this way. Yeah, like as just a filmmaker, she knows exactly how to execute a sequence.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I just want to say, too, like, you know, I was alluding to the female gaze, too. And what I think is also a strength of Point Break is, like, because the female gaze, I guess to elaborate of, like, how it's described, you know, as per Ms. Wolfe's
article for Rolling Stone. Yeah, I mean, yeah. it's from what I understand, it's the inversion of Laura Mulvey's male gaze theory from the 70s.
Yes, whereas, you know, with the male gaze theory, like, you know, maybe it's like you like these shots which focus on, like, parts of the female body, whereas with the female gaze, it's like you have the male body in its entirety in a shot. So I think, and the decision to shoot like that, and in some of the scenes that we have mentioned, I think it's the way of, like, I think of, like, Bigelow visually kind of like exposing these male characters and giving them a sense of vulnerability.
What I think there's an important distinction to make as well about. So according to Mulvey, the whole notion about the male gaze is that it is designed to objectify primarily female bodies, but can also objectify male bodies in some cases as well. And what's interesting, according to Wolf's article, is that she argues that the female gaze centered movie, it's not that it just simply captures bodies in their full stature. It serves to not objectify, but rather to identify and to recognize and to empathize, which is what we've been sort of talking about.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess if I had a nitpick to make about the film, I don't know if you had any nitpicks or complaints about it, but I just feel like, I guess with the character of Tyler, she does fall under a sort of, without getting too much spoilers, there is sort of a trope and cliche that she falls under, which when that plot point happened, I was just kind of like, okay, let's get this over with, you know, and I was kind of disinterested with that component.
Mm-hmm.
And leads into the third act.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you're talking about. And it is something where, on the one hand, I can see why the film went that direction. And it makes most sense because the film is really, it's not about her as much as it's about Johnny Utah and Bodhi and their relationship and their kinship, really. And I think, but it is something that it is, of course, a little disappointing when there's this cliche about, particularly pertaining to like a damsel in distress, and especially when the damsel in distress trope occurs to a particularly strong and fierce female character.
Which is unfortunately a cliche that we would see a lot in the movies from that time period, you know?
Right. Right. And, you know, and I think it is something where the film doesn't quite know what to do with Tyler at a certain point, because again, it's not really the relationship between her and Johnny Utah is not the key component in the film. And there are moments too, where for me, my nitpick is that the film, even though I love the way it leans into cliches, there are moments where the script is a little contrived and a little too easy in terms of how certain plot developments occur. Like, for example, Tyler doesn't know that Johnny's an FBI agent, and then she realizes that he's an FBI agent because he leaves his badge in his pants. You know?
His pants.
And it's like the ending of the movie too is thematically it makes sense, but to me there was I felt like it was a little awkward. It felt like it was kind of a coda to everything else that was happening, and I understand why it's there, but like, I feel like it's a slight misstep in terms of, well, especially in terms of logic, because, frankly, I mean, it makes, like, there are moments where the movie definitely beggars belief in terms of why would a character go to a place they know they're going to be pursued by law enforcement.
I mean, in a way, yes, but I could sort of understand why the character would do that, you know, considering, like, what we've seen of the character before and sort of how they tick and how they kind of, maybe the way they act is, like, not necessarily the most logical. And it's kind of more like living life so dangerously on the edge. It's like almost anticipating or desiring death, you know, seeing if they can cheat death.
Right. And that's something that I think, you know, it's something which has drawn criticism in terms of, oh, the film is ultimately ludicrous and it's convoluted. But I think you can also make the counter argument, which some have, that it's the part of the film that leans into what is a fundamental component of its generic trappings, which is this degree of fatalism, particularly within the existential context of a character like Bodhi. That the film, in a way, it reminds me not more of a Western, but more actually of noir. And particularly, it's sort of like a mixture between, well, it's like what would happen if Jean-Pierre Melville really let loose and had fun with a movie. I mean, I love Melville's movies, but those movies are cool. They're calm, they're cold to the touch, they're cool, efficient in their clockwork precision. But they are also about masculine codes, and these codes which men abide by, and how those codes often lead them to their death or their doom.
Yeah. So I take it you recommend Point Break?
Yeah, you know what? I would say that I would definitely say it's a film that going into it and knowing about its reputation, I was expecting a well-made action movie, and that's exactly what I got. But I got something a little more out of it too, which I was very pleasantly surprised by. And I think that the film is, it really, to borrow a phrase from Spinal Tap, it really does toe the fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that it's great entertainment, and I also feel like it's one of those movies that, honestly, if you do want to go in for something for a good fun time, I mean, it definitely will fit the bill. But I also think it's got more to it than maybe one would initially think just from hearing the premise. But it never gets, like, pretentious about itself. Like, maybe it would have had, like, someone like Ridley Scott directed it.
No, I completely agree. It never, it has absurdity, but it's never self-serious. I mean, it's serious enough that it takes its themes and its characters seriously, but it understands as well the sheer ludicrousness in terms of its plot as well as some of the set pieces. And those are all executed with just masterly, just completely masterful precision by Bigelow. And in terms of how she constructs images, like elemental images that echo each other in terms of waves and fire, like there's a really amazing shot of Swayze dressed up as Reagan, you know, with a gas pump, and he lights it on fire to burn a car as they're getting away. And there's something about that it conveys so much in terms of just male destructiveness. And also the legacy of masculine figures in American politics as well.
Well, particularly someone like Reagan, you know, throughout the 80s, and kind of one would argue like a lot of the destruction that he caused for so many Americans.
Well, as one of the first presidents who really mastered the persona through media, you know, that for a filmmaker like Bigelow, who's always been fascinated with how media and semiotics convey these masculine codes and these masculine images, I think it's a really striking moment in a career that's full of them. And I really kind of loved Point Break.
Yeah, I actually kind of loved it too. And I agree with you too about, I'll say too, the elements. It's always, you know, amazing how she works with the element, whether it's the ocean's waves or in this, or like the desert in the Hurt Locker, or even like sort of the southwest of Near Dark, you know, like how it's like a character in itself.
Right. Or even like right down to her first film, The Loveless, in terms of the Pacific Northwest and the way that that's sort of operates as a setting for these lonely, predominantly male figures as well. But I would say Point Break is, if you've never seen it, do yourself a favor and check it out, because it's a lot of fun. And I think that it's also got a lot to it that you can have a lot of fun talking about and thinking about and pouring it over, while at the same time just cackling at its audacity.
I agree with you 100%. Well, as much as we love talking about this movie, I think now's a good time as any to talk about recommendations of the episode. Like, have you got any?
No. No, I'm sorry, guys. No, actually, I do. No, I mean, I keep saying I don't, and then I feel like I will. I'll tell you what, like, I was oscillating between a couple of different recommendations this week, Alex. I was thinking about doing, at first I was thinking about Le Cercle Rouge by Melville, because I was reminded a lot of that particular film with Point Break, and I thought, oh, that would be a good recommendation of the week, but it's been about a decade since I've seen Le Cercle Rouge, and I didn't have really time to rewatch it, so I can't really give it the proper assessment or description that I think it deserves. But I will say this, I'm thinking about particular anniversaries and classic movies that we saw about a decade ago. Today, as we mentioned at the start of the episode, is July 24th, and it is actually the 40th anniversary of one of our favorite movies getting a theatrical release, and that is Brian De Palma's Blowout. And Blowout is the kind of a movie that I remember the first time I watched it was with you, Alex, actually. We watched it on DVD together, and I had heard that it was good. I had heard very promising things about it, and I had not really gotten into the work of Brian De Palma at that point. I think it might have been the first De Palma I'd seen, actually.
I think it was my first De Palma as well.
I mean, it's one of those things where for years, De Palma had been kind of, like Bigelow, actually, in a lot of ways, sort of cast, written aside as this second-rate filmmaker in a lot of respects. That they were only committed to genre filmmaking. And De Palma, in his case, has been accused of being a second-rate Hitchcock in terms of the way that he fuses Hitchcockian influences with other movies and other touchstones in American cinema, and also world cinema, particularly European cinema. And, I mean, that's no different for something like Blowout, which is, of course, this fusion between The Conversation and Antonioni's Blow Up, with in its plot about this movie soundman, Jack Terry, who's played by John Travolta, in what I would say is probably his best performance. I mean, I'm not a huge Travolta fan, but for me, he's quite revelatory in this movie.
Yeah, no, I think he's terrific in this film, and that's not something I usually say about Travolta, you know? And I have nothing against him as an actor, but, like, yeah, no, I think he's fantastic in this movie.
Well, he's fantastic, and it's kind of like we were talking about a little earlier in terms of, like, it's not sometimes the actor themselves, but the way they're cast in a film, or when a director casts them in a particular light, like we were talking about with Keanu Reeves earlier. But I think that in the case of Blow Up, Travolta is a lot closer to someone like how Jimmy Stewart was cast in Hitchcock's movies. And in a lot of ways, he is the Jimmy Stewart archetype from those movies, because he's a sound man who is driven by this sound that he heard while recording for a cheap slasher movie one night. And it's the sound of a car that went into a river, and he claims that, oh, there was a second bang because there was the sound of a blowout, but he thinks that there was a second bang, that there was a gunshot. And he is convinced that there's some sort of a conspiracy because the person who crashed in the car happened to be the governor of the state. I mean, it's not really specific. I believe it's Pennsylvania, because the ending of the movie also takes place in Philadelphia with the Liberty Day Parade, which is, of course, not a real holiday. But, you know, De Palma loves exploiting also American iconography, and particularly for big set pieces, which is also kind of Hitchcockian influence with what Hitchcock would do with these giant set pieces where people had to navigate these unfeeling or ignorant crowds, you know, in a desperate race against time. Because it is a desperate race against time. Terry has to find out who committed this murder that he suspects happened, this assassination. He teams up with a call girl who was with the governor in the car, played by Nancy Allen, in actually a really quite tender performance that I think elevates the character from some of the more regressive aspects of as she's written in the script. And they have to outwit and survive what is one of the scariest hitmen in any movie ever made, and he's played by John Lithgow. And that's another thing about this movie. Like, if Travolta was revelatory, I was completely stunned by Lithgow.
Yeah, I was too. And like, and Lithgow is a guy who I know that he's shown he's capable of giving dramatic performances, like, you know, or, you know, showing humanity and stuff. Like, you know, in films like maybe 2010 or in Terms of Endearment, you know, he was very good in those. But like, you know, when I, before this, I usually kind of viewed Lithgow as like kind of a hammy actor, you know, like, and he's great at doing like campy, hammy, over the top acting.
Sure.
But like, this was a revelatory, and like, it was very different. It's more like cool, calm, collected, but like deadly. And like, yeah, and he's very scary in the film.
Because he's like a shark. I mean, he's so precise in how, in his work. And he absolutely, it's not personal at all. It's all professional. But he, of course, kills quite a lot of people in this movie. And there are these moments where the film emulates a slasher movie, where he kind of takes on the moniker of, like, the Liberty Bell Strangler, you know, as a way to cover his tracks. And then that's an example of when the movie starts to bleed in these distinctions between the film that Jack is working on and then what is going on in this sort of, this line between reality and fiction gets blurred. And that's, of course, something that De Palma loves to do in all of his work. But I think that what makes Blowout a particularly striking masterpiece is that De Palma, I think, he conveys a real sense of tragedy and heartbreak and devastation. I mean, the movie is, it was famously a flop when it came out because of its bleak ending. And it is, for me, one of the bleakest endings of any major Hollywood movie. And it is, and it's particularly bleak because it's also underlined with De Palma's black comic sensibilities. I mean, it's something that every time I watch that movie and the last scene comes up, every person who's never seen it before, they always, there's a particular line at the end. Everybody just goes, oh.
I mean, it is like, it's cruel.
It's a cruel ending. But the thing is, I mean, I don't think it's just De Palma being sadistic. I think he's making a greater point about this loss of idealism as well. I think that it's clearly his most political film. And he's not utilizing politics simply to be trendy or hip. I think it's actually a part of his core ideological foundation in terms of just considering the relationship between art and filmmaking and how that's co-opted by really sinister, powerful figures. And particularly at the beginning of the Reagan era, it's a very striking political statement.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's funny because, yeah, Point Break, we mentioned about Reagan being one of the ex-presidents, and here Reagan comes up again too, like since the movie came out in 1981. And one of the shots I think of in the movie that for me sums up that kind of like that sense of doom, of like, you know, of futile efforts against like sort of this impending like, you know, disaster, calamity, I think is there's this great shot where the camera circles around, and I think you know the shot that I'm talking mm-hmm. about.
Mm-hmm. It rotates, yeah, in one location. The camera pretty much stays fixed in place, but it's sort of panning up and down, and it just mostly rotates in a circle. And yeah. I remember the first time yeah. I watched that movie, and that shot was, I was completely stunned by it, because I'd never seen a filmmaker do something like that with, it's almost, I mean, the cojones that someone has to say, you know what, I'm going to do something very simple, and yet I'm still going to make it feel, like, have you feel utterly entrenched within the emotions of what this character is feeling right now, but with just the simplest cinematic techniques.
And sometimes the simplest can be the most ingenious.
And that's the thing also that De Palma has been criticized before, of a sense of showmanship in terms of his virtuosic flourishes, I mean, in a lot of his films. But for me, Blowout is a really great work because those flourishes are in service of a real genuine love for filmmaking as well. I mean, De Palma loves films, and he's not snobbish about any sort of film and what, and the artistry or the meaning or the, in any film, you know, I mean, he does that even more with something like, I think he explores that avenue even further with a movie like Body Double, which is kind of the sleazier cousin to Blowout. And I love that movie too, but for me, Blowout is his best film, and it's one of those films that it's one of the greatest movies about filmmaking ever made.
I love Blowout too. You know, I mean, there's a few Brian De Palma films I actually genuinely love. Yeah. You know, but there's something about Blowout that for me, like, there's, it just shows like total confidence. This is a director who, like, he's not just embellishing himself like with these flourishes, but he knows what kind of styles or flourishes to do and how he can use them to tell the story that he wants to tell. And just that confidence there in what, again, could argue was a peak for him in his career. you know, I think it still is breathtaking, and I agree with you. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah. Every time I watch it, I think like, oh, I'm going to get kind of tired of it. And I ultimately don't. I mean, it's a film I've watched probably like 6 times, and I can definitely go for a 7th viewing.
Yeah. Well, this film I want to recommend is my first time watching it, but actually this one is kind of is a folk tale of sorts. And I was struggling too with thinking about, because I've been so busy, you know, with not just getting over this cold, but, you know, I've been working on a couple of plays that I haven't seen a lot of films, but like, I didn't know what to see. Like, should I talk about like how John Ford's How Green Was My Valley, which we just saw for the first time recently, which isn't a fable itself of like a forgotten time that's no longer there, you know, and
a community which no longer exists.
Yeah, exactly. And it's actually for a film that beats Citizen Kane, it's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very good. But I wanted to focus on something different because I noticed how actually coming at the time of recording, coming this Friday is actually one of the films that I'm actually legit. I haven't gone to the theater a lot this summer, but one of the films I'm looking forward to seeing in the theater is actually David Lowery's newest film, The Green Knight, mm-hmm. the set, which is sort of a medieval fantasy film. And so I decided, because I had seen his other films, I decided to go back to the beginning and start with his 2013 feature-length directorial debut, Ain't Them Body Saints, and which I remember when the movie first came out, and I remember it sort of making waves following its Sundance premiere and people mm-hmm. talking about it, but I decided to finally sit down and see it. And for those who don't know what it's about, it's kind of sort of inspired by the Bonnie and Clyde archetype, you can say, but it's a little different, where it's about this couple. Casey Affleck plays a guy named Bob. Rooney Mara is his lover, Ruth. And they're a couple who live... As the film opens, like, the only thing we get indicator, like, we don't really know the time period or anything. All we get of location is just this tile card that says, somewhere in Texas. And the film is about this couple who they're very much in love, and they're expecting a child. And so they kind of want to, you know, they want to make plans for themselves, make a life. And so they decide to do what any young couple in Texas would do, commit armed robbery. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, though, that goes terribly wrong. And after a shootout with the police, Bob decides to take the blame solely for what happened, because he was like, you know, you can't go to prison with me because we have a child. So you wait for me and I'll get out and I'll be, you know, I'm coming for you both. And so he goes to prison, and like 3-4 years pass. She gives birth to a daughter, and you know, and just trying to come to terms with, like, you know, his absence in their life. And then, of course, the news comes out that Bob has broken out of prison. His 6th attempt, and his first successful one. He's broken out of prison, and he's trying to... And it's pretty clear to the authorities that he's going to try to make his way to them. And she's trying to, like, figure out... And she's, of course, prepping for, like, when he comes so that they can run away together. But then there's the question of, does she want to run away with them or no, you know, especially when there are other components coming to play. Like, for example, there's this friendly officer who actually was involved in the shootout when Bob got arrested. And the officer is actually played by Ben Foster. And but then she sort of strikes up this friendship with them that might develop into something more. And as for Bob, you know, he has to evade not just the authorities, but also 3 bounty hunters who want to get the pretty price on his head. And, you know, watching the film, like, it's kind of interesting because, like, the way it's presented, you know, even I was kind of, like, thinking as I was sitting watching it, like, at first, okay, where is this going? Or, like, how... And even, like, the way it sort of... There's almost an elliptical, like... People compared it to Malick when it came out, and I could see, like, there's an elliptical sort of editing to it where it shows, like, just the sequence of events. And sometimes you get some insight, but not a whole lot of, like, psychological insight into the characters. And that was deliberate on Lowry's part. Like, he said when talking about editing the film, he didn't want to talk about the how, but more like the sequence of events of, like, what happens. And I think that the effect it creates, it's kind of like if somebody was sitting down and, like, saying, I have the story I want to tell you. It's about a pair of lovers and this place in this mystical place. You know, no time I can give specified, but... And it's very much, I think, these are themes which Lowry would be very interested in exploring throughout his body of work, where I think he's very interested in talking about stories and about what kind of stories we want to say about ourselves and, like, the stories we want to leave behind for people long after we're gone. Mm. I mean, he's been interested, I feel like, in exploring that time and again, not just like on a cosmic level with Ghost Story, his second collaboration with Marr and Affleck, but even in a children's entertainment like Pete's Dragon,
which I remember actually. Pete's Dragon was the first Lowry film that I saw, and it was a pleasant surprise. A, because I really cannot stand the original Disney version of Pete's Dragon. I know it's a classic for some people, but I think it's a genuinely awful movie. And so I was very pleasantly surprised that it was not the same at all, and it was actually quite good. And then it didn't feel like a carbon copy. Like I remember watching it and thinking to myself, okay, like whoever is making this movie has a very distinct sensibility in terms of, okay, they've got a little bit of the Malickian influence there, but also a little bit of Altman in terms of his depictions of communities and their dynamics. And he's, I mean, Lowry is definitely, as a filmmaker, he's much more interested in seeing how his characters interact with one another in these spaces. I mean, it's interesting that we were also even talking last summer about George Washington, which he was influenced by.
Yeah, that was another, like, you know, and it's interesting, like, watching this movie, you know, I feel like you can see the influences of also, like, Mal and Altman, you know, because apparently he was inspired by, for the visual aesthetic, him and his cinematographer, Bradford Young, who you may know for doing such films like Arrival and Solo, you know, they were very much inspired, the visual look, they were inspired by films like McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Heaven's Gate. And yeah, he was inspired by George Washington as well. And you can see those influences, I feel, in this, not just with the visual aesthetic, but also with things like the casting of Keith Carradine in the film as well. And so it's interesting to see, like he's a director who, I think some people liked it, though some people felt it was derivative of other directors. But I think Lowry has kind of carved a name for himself as an independent American director, where he is influenced by certain directors, and he wears those influences on his sleeves, but he uses those influences in a way to kind of like inform like what kind of director he wants to be, what kind of stories he wants to tell, which is interesting enough about telling stories.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad that, you know, I mean, I still haven't seen Anthem Body Saints. I've seen everything else by Lowry, so I definitely need to check it out.
Did you all see The Old Man and the Gun?
Oh, no, that's right. I still haven't seen The Old Man and the Gun.
Because it's interesting, because even that one, I think, and it's interesting, too, like, how he explores, in his movies, he's explored different kinds of genres or, like, but those themes are still there, because even, like, with The Old Man and the Gun, it's the whole thing of, like, Robert Redford trying to figure out, like, what kind of person he wants to be, you know, what kind of stories left to tell. And even, like, there's a closing montage in The Old Man and the Gun, which shows sort of his life of crime. And kind of, there's sort of a cheekily sort of tribute to, you know, by including actual archive footage of old Bob Redford movies of, like, him as a young man.
So, well, and that's the thing, like, that movie, it seems like, is as much kind of a metatextual commentary on the actor of Robert Redford, who himself said it was his last movie and then he ended up being in Avengers Endgame.
But, you know, let's just pretend his last movie is The Old Man and the Gun. I mean, could we?
I mean, you know, I just wish that he actually appeared as President Bob Redford in Watchmen.
I mean, yeah, but, you know, Old Man and the Gun is still a pretty solid vehicle. And I think Anthem Body Saints is also, like, even though I think it's a solid debut for a director who, honestly, I think got better, you know, with his subsequent features. And I, you know, I don't want to jinx it, but I'm highly looking forward to The Green Knight, you know, to see, especially since this is a medieval fantasies territory that is completely unexplored. And yeah, because I feel like Pete's Dragon is the only Disney remake that I legitimately liked.
Yeah.
You know, that.
From the last decade. Yeah, I completely agree. It's the only one that I feel is actually worth watching.
And honestly, you know, it's his name that's why I'm actually curious to see his Peter Pan remake.
Well, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how that one turns out whenever it comes out. But until then, I've definitely got to catch Anthem Body Saints. I know it's on the Criterion Channel through the rest of the month, so I've got to check that out. Actually, Blowout is also on the Criterion Channel, so and under their neo-noir banner. So if you haven't seen either of them, definitely check them out.
And definitely check out Point Break. But we'd love to hear your opinions in the comments. Do you have, like, a favorite Catherine Bigelow film, or a favorite Brian De Palma picture, or a favorite David Lowry movie?
Or do you have any key tips about surfing, or surfing in movies? I know that, you know, at some point, we've got to talk about Blue Crush and all of the other kinds of... There's a whole subgenre of surfing movies. I feel actually Point Break really kind of opened the door for, you know, Lilo and Stitch.
Surf's Up.
Surf's Up, of course. I mean, that's going to have an anniversary next year as well. I mean, I guess we should just do a whole miniseries about surfing movies.
Why not?
Why not? I mean, until that day, we will be here watching more stuff and bringing you more episodes in our Smells Like Twin Critics miniseries. We're really looking forward to some more episodes that we've got in the pipeline that will be coming your way in the weeks to come. But until those pop up, as always, be well, stay safe, and continue watching great movies.
And remember, brah, we're all in this together.